you so much for having me this morning. My name is Nan Madden. I work at the Minnesota Budget Project. If you're not familiar with our work, we do nonpartisan research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues. We particularly take a look at how state fiscal decisions impact the well-being of low-income Minnesotans and other vulnerable populations. I'm going to talk about a couple of different tax topics today, and then if I don't hit on something that is really burning in your mind, maybe we can hit that in the Q&A part. Just want to talk a little bit about what's kind of the current state of our tax system here in Minnesota and a little bit about how we got to where we are. Talk about how the tax debate has played out this year, including in the realm of constitutional amendments, which have been very popular at the Capitol in the last couple of years. Talk a little bit about what kind of tax discussion I think is coming up next year at the state, and then a little bit on the federal side of things. And then I think kind of throughout what I want to be talking about is how are we doing, and when we're talking about taxes, in terms of bringing in enough revenue to fund our priorities, and how are we doing in terms of spreading the responsibility for funding those services in a fair way across the population. So the reason we do this work at the Minnesota Budget Project, why we invest our own resources in spending time and looking at budget and tax decisions at the government level, is because we really think that the public sector is a partner with all of us, with nonprofits, with the business community, all working to build a state with a high quality of life, and ultimately trying to build a state where everybody has the opportunity to succeed. We think public investments are an important part of that picture, and we think that our state does better and our economy does better when we're making the right kinds of public investments. And when I say public investments, that means everything from our infrastructure, our roads and bridges. It's the human capital of the people who live here. It includes the way we have a system of laws that protects our safety, protects our property, and enforces contracts. All of that is very important for the economy. It also includes the way we take care of each other and try to make sure that all people can live in dignity, regardless of the circumstances they might be in. And it also includes our cultural and environmental amenities. We think all of those things make Minnesota a great place. But we think that if you look at Minnesota today, our tax system is not raising enough revenue to invest in those kinds of priorities. We have seen that over the past decade or so, as we have faced economic hard times, and we have faced that problem largely through cuts in services, that the quality of our services and the availability of services have eroded. We've lost ground compared to other states. We think we're not making the investments that are needed for our future prosperity. And as an example of that, with the budget that got passed last year, Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, is going to spend less on higher ed than we did 10 years ago. And that's not adjusting for inflation. It's not adjusting for the fact that there's more students today, just fewer dollars than we did 10 years ago as state investment in higher ed. And that's despite the fact that experts tell us we're going to need more workers in the future that have some kind of higher ed, either degree or credential. So we're not making the investments that would be important for our future. We have seen that state and local government today in Minnesota is a smaller share of the economy than we were 10, 15 years ago. And so it really raises questions to us whether we are raising the revenues and making the investments that will pay off in the future in a strong economy. Not only do we think that our tax system today is not bringing in enough revenue for what we want to invest in, but we also have seen that it has become less fair. We've pushed a little bit more responsibility for funding public services onto people with low and moderate incomes. And it's been discussed quite a bit through the last gubernatorial election, through last year's budgets debate. But looking at the data that comes from our state Department of Revenue, and if we look at the Minnesotans with the greatest income, those with the 1% highest incomes, they pay a smaller share of their incomes in total state and local taxes than most other Minnesotans do. And I gave you a handout that shows that information as on a graph. Now, there's a lot of different reasons to get to that kind of situation. Economic trends are one. Across the country, we are seeing changes in the economy that are contributing to a rise in income inequality, and our tax system reflects that. But also, we did, as a state, some significant income tax cuts in the 1990s. And since then, we've become a little more reliant on property taxes. And the combination of those things also pushes a little more responsibility for funding state and local services to people in the low and middle of the income range. So we've had a pretty robust debate about that situation and whether it's a good idea to do something about that. What might be the best way to do that? Certainly, Governor Dayton has been very clear on his desire to address both the adequacy issue and the fairness issue through a new income tax rate, proposed what was often called the fourth tier income tax, because it would add a fourth income tax bracket at the state level on the wealthiest Minnesotans, and has said he will be continuing to talk about that next year. This year, we have not had the same kind of debate as we had last year. Last year, we were passing the budget. We pass a two-year budget here in Minnesota, and there was a big debate about how to pass that budget, how to address a budget deficit. This year, it's been a little quieter year, probably the quietest in terms of budget bills over at the Capitol that I've seen in a long time. That's because we did not need to set the budget this year, because we did last year. We were just get to continue on in it. We did not have a deficit. Someone asked me earlier, what's some good news? I'm happy to be able to tell you for once, we don't have a deficit this year. So that was nice. We actually had some small surpluses, but because of the way our state laws go, it was already determined where those surplus dollars would go. So we didn't even really have much of a debate about how to spend the surplus. Under existing state law, it said when we had a surplus, we had to pay back our cash flow account and our budget reserve, kind of the state savings accounts, and after that start to reverse the funding shift that has delayed a considerable amount of payments from the state to schools. So not the same kind of active budget debate at the Capitol this year. But certainly still having a discussion about tax. Both the House and Senate have passed tax bills. They have some similarities and some differences. I think both the House and Senate tax bills share the fact that they include tax cuts that grow over time. They're phased in, so the cost of them is smaller today, but it grows over time, which I think presents a real challenge when we know that we still haven't, as a state, found a sustainable way to fund our priorities. These bills kind of make that problem more serious. And these two tax bills have their tax cuts primarily focused on tax cuts for businesses, although there are some variations between the two. If we look at the House omnibus tax bill, they make $95 million in tax cuts for this budget cycle, $420 million in the next budget cycle, and the cost grows over time. The biggest cuts are by they start to phase out what's called the statewide property tax. This is a property tax paid only by businesses and cabins, and it's paid to the state. So it's different from the kind of normal property taxes that we're more used to that are paid at the local level. It's a property tax paid by businesses and cabins that goes to the state. Under the House bill, that would be slowly phased out until it was entirely gone in 2025. And while the cost of that is pretty small in this budget cycle, if we did it all at once, so you had a clearer sense of the magnitude, for example, I believe that business property tax raises about $1.7 billion in this budget cycle. So it's not the largest revenue source, but it's not a tiny item either. That tax bill also has some other increases in some tax provisions that the proponents would hope will be a spur to business growth. So it increases the research and development credit has a new tax incentive for some emerging biotechnology businesses. It increases what's called the angel investor credit, going to investors in certain kind of startup businesses. On the property tax side, for homeowners, there is a small increase in what's called the targeted property tax refund, which is a refund for people whose property taxes go up quickly one year to the next. So if your property taxes go up by 12% and at least $100 just in one year, that refund is available. One of the things that is most, I think, deeply concerning about the House bill is that it pays for those tax cuts in the short term by deep cuts to the renter's credit, a property tax refund for our low and moderate income renting households. Now, these are folks who already took a cut last year. The renter's credit was cut last year. And this bill would cut it by another 38%. The people affected, their average refund would be cut by $213. And about one in five of the folks who currently receive that refund would become ineligible, and that's over 66,000 families. So we certainly have made the case that if the proponents of the business tax cuts think those are a really good idea, they need to find a different way to pay for it rather than asking this small number of struggling Minnesotans to foot the bill. But as I mentioned, it's only in the short term that that cut pays for the tax cuts. In the longer term, they are much larger than what the cuts to the renter's credit could make up and just creates a larger deficit problem in the future. The Senate tax bill is similar but not identical to the House bill. It also has a plan to phase out the statewide business property tax, does it a little bit differently. Also does some increases to the angel investor credit and has an increase in that targeted property tax refund. One thing unique in the Senate bill that isn't in the House bill is they do have a one-time $62 million income tax cut for married couples. It's a item of reflecting federal tax changes for the state to adjust to that at a one-time basis. Also a new income tax benefit for people with military retirement pay. Now, Senate tax bill is similar to the House bill in that it does pay for the tax cuts in the short term, but not in the long run. Very glad they do not use cuts to the renter's credit to pay for it, but their funding source is also problematic. The Senate tax bill would take $100 million out of the state's budget reserve, but they say that transfer can be avoided. The Dayton administration can come up with savings anywhere they want in the budget and book that savings, and then you don't have to draw on the budget reserve. So also problematic, we are still in a pretty uncertain time with the economy. We're going into a deficit situation next budget cycle. We don't think it's a great idea to be taking money out of the budget reserve. And just in general, we feel that if legislation is going to make cuts, it's the legislature's job to identify how they want those cuts made. The public can have more of some input into whether they think those cuts are in the right place. So the House and Senate, since they're not the same, they are in conference committee to work out the differences between them. Also sounds like they're doing some negotiations with the governor to see what eventually might come out of that process. I think it's extremely unlikely that the governor will accept a tax bill that makes the deficit bigger in the future. He has said that. They're either going to need to come up with some kind of different approach in these tax bills, or I think that's a bill that's likely headed for a veto. But certainly is possible if they want that they could come up with something that has kind of just a short-term impact. But we're watching very closely since obviously we're concerned very deeply about those cuts to the renter's credit being on the table. So, given that we've had kind of a little bit kind of quieter budget debate this year, does not mean that there hasn't been some very, very important discussions going on. And actually where we've been spending most of our time this year is focusing on some constitutional amendments that would fundamentally change how we set our budgets at the state level. Last year, there were three such amendments introduced that we felt were probably the most serious threat to the state's future that we had seen. And the reason I say that is because constitutional amendments are fundamentally different than other kinds of decisions we make because they are so permanent. They are locked into the Constitution. And if down the road we find some unintended consequences or we don't really like how it's working out, you got to go back to the ballot and back to a vote of the people and amend the Constitution again to reverse that policy. So we were really deeply concerned going into session. Not only had we seen some action on these amendments last year, but they had been discussed, and particularly a supermajority requirement, and I'll talk a little bit more about what that is. We heard that described as a priority by the majority party going into session. Last summer, there was this Reform 2.0 agenda that a number of legislators in the majority party were involved in and had meetings around the state and talked to citizens and said, we really want to have this reform agenda, and supermajority was discussed as part of that. And also last year, as part of the budget deal that got done to end the shutdown, there was some media reporting that said as part of the way they got enough votes to pass that budget deal, that some kind of promise was made to the more conservative members of the majority caucus that there would be something regarding these supermajority amendment. But the actual nature of that promise was a little unclear. But that made us very concerned about the momentum that constitutional amendments had. And then there was just kind of a general discussion about how many amendments can you put on? Is it going to be three? Is it going to be four? Is it going to be five? The other concern about constitutional amendments that we see as in a process way is that it doesn't have the same kinds of checks and balances as other legislation. So normally in the legislative process, you got to find agreement between the House and Senate. They got to work out something with the governor. But with the constitutional amendments, you just need a majority vote in each body of the legislature. No role for the governor, goes on the ballot, and then becomes permanently part of our Constitution if a majority of people voting in the election approve the measure. So what were the specific amendments that we're talking about? First was supermajority. This is the one that got the most attention. It would require a 3/5 or 60% supermajority vote in each body of the legislature in order to pass an increase in state income or sales taxes, a new statewide tax, or increase the authority of local governments to raise property taxes. So it doesn't apply to actions at the local level to increase property taxes. Doesn't apply to decisions made at the state level that create pressure on local property taxes. Only things that the state does that actually, gives local government more authority to raise property taxes. And I think that is one of the big concerns, is that the actual language of the bill, I think most people, voters reading the bill, would think that includes, it reads like a property tax cap. And it does not function that way. And we think actually if you pass this amendment, you'd be more likely to see property tax increases. But I think it's a reasonable reading by members of the public that the bill language sounds like a property tax cap, although technically it is correct. That bill had the most momentum in the House. It already passed the House Tax Committee last year, so it already had moved a step in the process. So we were really concerned about that supermajority proposal. And we've done a fair amount of analysis, and we have a lot of written materials about that on our website if folks are more interested in that. The second amendment that was in play is what we shorthand call the 98% amendment. That had appeared to have more support in the Senate. Nearly all members of the majority party in the Senate signed on as authors. It takes a little bit different approach and does a couple of different things. First, it says when the state passes its budget, it can only spend 98% of the revenues that it's forecasted to get. 2% gets put aside in what's called a budget reserve. Now, we have long argued that the state needs to build up a more robust budget reserve. But you do that when times are good so that you can use those dollars when times are tough to smooth through a deficit situation. Either you have a little bit of cushion if you have just kind of a short-term problem, or it gives you a little bit of time to make some smart decisions about how to address your budget deficit, or, you know, gives you some time for spending cuts to phase in or revenues to phase in. You don't have to take drastic action. That's not what happens in this bill. This bill says, or this amendment says, you put 2% of your revenues into a reserve account all the time. Even if that tips you into a deficit, even if you're already in deficit and it makes it worse, you're still taking 2% of your revenues and setting them aside. It also makes it more difficult to use the budget reserve. It puts a 3/5 supermajority vote in order to use the budget reserve. And it says you can only use the budget reserve in the case of emergency. Similarly, you can spend more than the 98% restriction, but again, only with a supermajority vote and only if an emergency exists. To give you a sense of what the practical implication of such an amendment would be, if this amendment had been in place last year, so we got a budget deal that ended the shutdown that made over $2 billion in spending cuts, shifted monies from the schools, and raised money by selling off our future tobacco revenues. If this amendment had been in place, we would have had to come up with another $1.3 billion in either cuts or more of that kind of gimmicky stuff like tobacco bonds and borrowing timing shift in the schools on top of what we did do. We think these kinds of amendments, while proposed as reforms, actually get in the way of common sense decision making, and by raising the bar and requiring a supermajority requirement for making budget decisions, it just is an invitation for more gridlock, making it even harder to get to budget choices because it allows a small number of legislators to hold out support for legislation that the majority do support, but they can hold things up. Also, we think we'll promote more kinds of gimmicks to get around the requirements. So I think if we had supermajority for state tax increases, well, then we're going to have more local tax increases or more increases in fees, in tuition, in things that are outside of that requirement. If we had the 98% that applies to the general fund, state's general fund, a great incentive to try to move things out of the general fund and have more dedicated funding sources and things happening outside of that purview. I really would like us to spend our creative thinking on how we can provide the best services with the best bang for the buck. I don't want us spending our time thinking about how can I fund this program in a way that gets around this rule in about 98% or supermajority vote. We want creative thinking about services, not creative accounting, right? We think they actually get in the way of trying to do actual tax reform, supermajority vote. I think most people think that there are changes needed to our tax system. We probably have there's not universal agreement about what those changes could be, but if we had a supermajority requirement for tax increases, you could have a pretty comprehensive, sweeping tax reform plan. And maybe you tried pretty hard to make that revenue neutral, but if it raises a little bit of money, now you have to have a supermajority vote. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to us. And actually, while it talks about being a really good way to, the proponents will say it reins in spending, we don't think the data necessarily supports that. And when we took a look on the property tax side of things, when we looked at states that had very strict supermajority limits, similar to what we're looking at here in Minnesota, compared to states that didn't, over the last 10 years, those strict supermajority states did have higher average increases in local property taxes. And we think that makes sense because it tends to push responsibility down to the local level. So we were very concerned about these amendments going into session. We've worked with a large number of partners and have been talking with legislators about what we think the unintended consequences of these amendments would be. And I think we've had some good success. And as we've talked to members saying that, you know, that might not be the way we want to go. So we're not out of session yet. These things can always come up. As I said last year, it sounded like this issue came up as part of the very final negotiations about getting the final budget deal passed, so we're still watching very closely. I did bring today a sign-up sheet if it's an issue that you are interested in being kept up to date on and knowing if these issues move. You can leave that with me today or get that to our office later. Like I said, we're going to be watching it very closely through the end of session, and while we think we've had some good success this year, we know these ideas do tend to come back. So we want to be prepared. Okay. So that's where we've been this session. Next year, in 2013, that will be a budget setting year. We will need to talk about passing the next two-year budget. And the way things are forecasted right now, it is expected that we'll have a shortfall of over $1 billion that we're going to need to address. So I think we will be talking again over at the Capitol and in the budget debate, the governor's fourth tier income tax proposal. But also the Dayton administration is planning to bring forward a more broad tax reform package. And I think that opens up opportunities to talk about a whole number of issues in the tax system. And I'd like to now talk a little bit about some things that in the tax system and in the wider economy that I think have had the unintended consequence of further eroding our tax base and also has had some negative impacts on how tax distribution. So I'd like to talk about the increased use of income tax deductions and credits to achieve policy goals. But also the impact of changing technology. So I've been doing tax policy work for about 15 years, and one thing that I've seen, and I think others have identified, is both at the state and federal level, there's been an increase interest in using the tax code to achieve policy goals instead of appropriations. So what do I mean by that? So if we think about the goal, policy goal, of helping more people afford to send their kids to college, right? Well, now on the federal level, we have a number of tax credits that you can take to help afford either tuition, you know, now you can deduct your interest on your student loan. There's a number of things we're doing in the tax code. We've got the 529 savings plan, all these things using the tax system to help with the goal of making college more affordable. Well, you could conceivably do the same kind of thing by direct spending, directly funding colleges and universities, funding financial aid, subsidized loans. You know, all of those are possible policy choices for the same goal, but I think over the past 10, 15 years and maybe longer, we've seen more interest in doing these things on the tax side rather than the spending side. Now, if well designed, tax credits and deductions can be well crafted, targeted, and reach their goal. Now, for example, the federal earned income tax credit is probably the nation's most successful anti-poverty program. It is well targeted. The state has a counterpart, the working family credit, and there's a broad system of support in both the public sector and the private sector to make sure people know about that credit, apply for it, and receive it. And it's very successful. But on the whole, I think the fact that we are doing more and more things in the tax code and more of these as income tax deductions has the unintended consequence that these tend to miss their target and they tend to be upside down in the benefits they deliver, especially if it's an income tax deduction. So many deductions are meant to provide an incentive for people to take some kind of behavior, beneficial behavior. Go to college, buy a home, purchase long-term care insurance. But itemized deductions miss their target in that they tend to leave out the people for whom that incentive would most likely make the difference in whether they'd take that behavior. The benefit only goes to those who itemize, which tends to leave out lower income people and people who don't own their own homes. If you don't have your mortgage interest deduction, often itemizing is not worth the trouble. And you also need to have enough resources to make that purchase first, pay the tuition, buy the home, whatever, and then get the tax benefit significantly later. So cash flow problem that leaves out many people with more moderate incomes. Itemized deductions are also upside down in that they give the greatest benefit for those with the highest income, and probably if those are the people for whom the incentive makes the least impact in terms of did it tip them into making that decision. They have the highest value in the higher tax bracket. So, you know, it doesn't quite hit the target. You probably are getting some of the people that you're trying to reach, but other people who were going to take that action anyway. So we're just providing a tax benefit for things that people were going to do anyway, so that's not particularly efficient. Another concern with doing more, trying to do more policy goals through the tax code is it's not a level playing field between these tax incentives and direct spending. So, for example, let's look at the policy goal of helping families afford a home. And I do mean a home, not the more narrow buying a house. So we're more likely to help low-income families afford a home through rental subsidies, building affordable housing, some kind of home ownership program, more likely to be direct spending. Where middle and upper income people, when we help them buy a home, so that's primarily through the mortgage interest deduction. Low-income families will find, as they seek to get help buying a home, that because those are spending programs, the amount of spending is probably capped. There definitely are not enough, for example, rent subsidies for all the people who could qualify and could use them. And on the other side, with a tax benefit, it is very rare that we would cap a tax benefit. Normally, all people eligible will get it. I think the only example that comes to mind of a capped tax benefit, for example, is there's been a federal tax credit for people who buy hybrid vehicles. And there was a cap of for each manufacturer, you could only get a certain number of people claiming that credit, and then there weren't going to be any more. That's really the exception to the rule. We don't say, you know, only the first 10,000 people who file their taxes get a mortgage interest deduction, right? Everybody gets it if you qualify. And this disparity, this lack of a level playing field really plays out when times are tight, right? Because if the state needs to balance its budget, we're going to start talking about how much are we going to cut housing subsidy? How much are we going to cut back on development of affordable housing? But we don't kind of in that same menu say, how much should we cut back on mortgage interest deduction? Those tax incentives tend to be kind of in place and protected when times are tight. Not 100%, but certainly that's a rarer discussion to look at the tax side of things than on the spending side. And certainly at the state level, about the only time we talk about it on the tax side is, again, when we're talking about something that goes to low and moderate income people like the renter's credit. So while the intent, you know, certainly is not the intent of people who have promoted tax deductions as a way to get the policy goal to undermine the tax system and make it less fair, I think the cumulative effect of doing more and more of these things is that we're eroding our tax base, so we're not bringing in as much revenue, and it's a contributor to a lack of fairness in the system. Another issue that has had that kind of same kind of unintended consequence is just changes in technology. There's new technologies, there's new ways of of doing business, and that our tax code is not always kept up with that. So the example I like to use, my husband and I are big music fans. If we want to buy some, I will still call them records, but if I want to buy a new album, I can go to my local record store and buy a CD. I can go online and buy a CD, or I can go online and buy that music as a digital download. And those three things are treated differently for tax purposes. If I go down the street to Electric Fetus to buy my record, I'm going to pay my Minnesota sales tax. If I buy it online, it actually depends who I buy it from, whether I'm going to pay the sales tax. And if I buy it from a large retailer that doesn't have physical presence in Minnesota, then it's free, right? No, I'm supposed to keep track. The end of the year, I total up my purchases from catalog and internet. If it's over $770 a year, then I need to remit my own sales tax to the state. Everybody does that, right? Very, very small number of people do. I think 99% of them are probably employees of the Department of Revenue. But you know, it's kind of, we've shifted that responsibility onto the consumer to pay the remit the sales tax on their own. And I think some people know they're supposed to and don't, but probably most people don't even know that that's what they're supposed to be doing. And in the case of the digital download, well, that's not even me buying a product, that's me buying a service. So, you know, services tend not to be taxed. So there's certainly a historical reason why we do it that way. It was true back in the 40s that to expect a catalog retailer to understand tax systems in every state and locality and collect all of that was an unreasonable burden on them, way too difficult. I think times have changed. I think it's hard to make the argument that Amazon can suggest 15 books I might like, but can't figure out whether a book is taxable in Minnesota and collect it. You know, but that's kind of the discussion we have. And then, you know, and then there is this, you know, almost philosophical debate about whether it is actually the same thing to download a digital file or listen to streaming music. Is that the same thing as buying a CD? Some of these debates get a little existential. But, you know, as we're having that debate, some of that is just about responding to technology, but we shouldn't forget that then there are implications. High-income households are more likely to buy goods and services over the internet than low and moderate-income people who are more likely to be buying from their local stores. Is there a level playing field? And it's been interesting to watch how this debate has gone. This level playing field argument used to be kind of mom-and-pop local business against big internet catalog company. But now it's even big local business, Target, Best Buy versus Amazon, whether they have a level playing field. So it's interesting debate going on, but I think one point of view we like to bring into that debate is let's keep in mind, while certainly the main point of that argument is not about tax incidents, but we should keep in mind how the combination of many different choices we make do have a consequence for how much revenue we're going to collect and how that tax responsibility is distributed. All right. So I think we're going to hear those kind of debates going forward as we talk about tax reform and many other juicy items, I'm sure. I'm going to switch gears and talk a bit about what's going on at the federal level. I spend less time on federal issues, so I'll be more brief there, but it is in some ways a similar discussion. We have a budget situation on the federal level where in the future we face deficits that are not sustainable. However, I would point out that I think there is a real danger too much focus on deficit reduction now will harm our economic recovery. And I think we do need to be careful about not, while there definitely is need to start making decisions now and start getting the plan in place for bringing down those future deficits, the size of those future deficits are not what's creating our economic trouble now. And if we overreact and feel like we need to solve that problem all at once right now, that's not going to be good for us as a nation. When we look at the federal tax system, if you look at all parts of the tax system, not just the income tax, but also the payroll taxes and federal excise taxes, the federal tax system is mildly progressive. And I brought a handout from a national group that has a nice chart that shows just federal taxes, but also if you add in what state and local taxes look like, so you have a sense of the distribution there. We hear a lot, as we do at the state level and on the federal level, about what large share of taxes are paid by the wealthiest. But one of the things that analysis points out, similar to the state level, is that wealthy people do pay a large share of total taxes. It's about in proportion to their share of total income in the state, in the country. We think that as we're having this discussion at the federal level about how to bring down those future deficits, that revenues must be part of that discussion. A couple of reasons why. First of all, tax cuts over the past decade are a major contributing factor to those future deficits. If all of the tax cuts passed in 2001 and 2003 were allowed to expire at the end of the year as they're scheduled, that future deficits would be cut in about half. So they're a major contributor to those future deficits. The other major contributors in growth in the deficits in recent years clearly have been the deep economic recession and the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. There has been some growth in spending, but that is not the major contributor to the growth in federal deficits. And similar to a point we have made at the state level, if you look at what it would take to bring down our federal deficits and do it all through cuts, that would just be too painful and too dramatic for the nation. So an example of this, Representative Ryan has put out a budget that looks at bringing down the size of the deficit through cuts only. 62% of his proposed cuts are to services for low-income people: healthcare, student aid, food stamps, and job training. If we do it all on the spending side, the burden of bringing down our deficit, a lot of which is coming from tax cuts, falls too heavily on the most vulnerable people in our country. Also, when we take that kind of approach and we do those cuts to healthcare, including Medicaid, that's just kicking the problem down to the states. I think we're going to see a similar kind of tax debate on the federal level. We'll certainly be talking about tax rates. Also, on the federal level, then, you have this discussion, what's been very prominent lately, is whether it makes sense to continue the practice of taxing investment income at a lower rate than wages, than earned income. And then we're also going to have, I think, this tax expenditures, this deductions and credits, exemptions discussion at the federal level. And as I mentioned when I was talking about the state, that those benefits tend to be upside down. I saw analysis recently that said that 66% of the benefits from tax expenditures on the federal level go to the top 20% of the income scale, and almost a fourth of the tax benefit from tax expenditures go to the wealthiest 1% of the population. So if tough decisions need to be made, I think we will need to think about whether that's an efficient allocation of dollars. And while it's not a tax issue, I think it's clear for the federal deficits to come down in a substantial way, we do need to figure out how to rein in the rising costs of healthcare system-wide. It's not a problem that exists only in government-funded healthcare, but also in the private healthcare system, and we need a system-wide set of changes. I'm not a healthcare expert, so I can't tell you what those would be, but that if we don't make progress there, it's going to be very, very difficult to bring in those deficits. There's going to be some decision points coming up at the federal level that will really force this discussion, although we're really having it now, and certainly in the election it's going to be a big issue. The Bush era income and estate tax cuts expire at the end of this calendar year, so clear decision point there. In those tax cuts, package of tax cuts, and also under some of the stimulus, some of our tax credits for low-income families were expanded. So whether to keep those expansions will be part of that debate. Whether we continue the payroll tax holiday is also up this year. Also an issue of debate probably will be the fact that under health care reform, there's a change to Medicare taxes, which would make they would be a bit higher on the wealthy, and that starts in 2013. So there may be a debate about whether that will indeed go forward. And then a number of people are raising in the federal debate to the issue about corporate tax reform, and is there a need there for, again, some kind of looking at all the different incentives that go to particular industries or particular kind of activity. Should we have fewer of those? And if you do enough of that, you can actually bring the rate down for everybody. But you know, the fundamental debate is the same, whether it's at the state or federal level. How do we sustainably fund our priorities? And as we look for that way, how can we do that in a way where the responsibility for funding public services is distributed in a way that is fair? Thank you.